Today is Monday, February 5th. We're going to wrap up blood disorders, cover some heart anatomy, and spend some time on exam one review. Okay, so our first review question says, what blood type can receive A positive, B positive, and O positive?
AB positive.
Good, good. So all of those antigens, A, B, and Rh, are something that the AB positive person's blood is just going to recognize as familiar. Okay. Any questions with this one? Okay. What blood type carries the antigens for A, B, and Rh? AB positive. Good, good. How did you know it was positive and not negative? Rh, right. They carry an Rh antigen. I could have said this another way. I could have said carries the Rh factor, or I could have just straight out said this is positive. Okay. So any of those would help point us to the Rh antigen then. All right. Let's see. Which blood type listed below is compatible with A negative in a transfusion?
O negative.
O negative. Good. Why is that one the best choice?
Because O can be given to anyone because it doesn't have any antigens for A and B only.
Good. No antigens on the O negative blood. It is a universal
donor.
Good. So there's nothing foreign about the blood cell in an O negative blood that's going to introduce anything that would trigger an immune response in the A negative person. Good. And let's see our next question. What blood type carries an anti-A, anti-B, and potentially an anti-Rh antibody?
O negative.
O negative. Good. How did you know it was O?
Because A and B.
Good, because you can't fight yourself, right? Okay, so you wouldn't have A or B blood types here because you're not going to form an antibody against yourself. And then how did you know it was probably O negative?
Anti-Rh.
Anti-Rh, right. And of course, if you're O positive, you're not going to form an anti-Rh antibody against yourself. How'd you do with these four? Good. Get 3 out of 4? Okay. Any questions on these? All right. Why don't we go back and finish up the blood info? We were on the very bottom of page 28 and here on Wednesday of last week. So there's just a very small amount on the bottom of page 28. On the bottom of page 28, we were talking about blood clotting. And just to distinguish the two terms, to clot the blood means to coagulate the blood. And I want to make sure we see there's a difference between that term and agglutination. What happens during agglutination?
Red blood cells start
rupturing. Good. Red blood cells may rupture. And what is binding and attacking them?
The antibodies.
Antibodies. Good. So the difference here is agglutination is an antibody-antigen reaction. We sometimes call agglutination a transfusion reaction. But by contrast, coagulation leads to blood clotting, and that has to do with a series of steps and phases that involve various factors that ultimately form a fibrin mesh network. Okay. So we were kind of leaving class here the other day talking about fibrinolysis. That process is necessary after your vessel's been healed. We no longer need a clot left inside a healed vessel, so fibrinolysis removes that clot. Now, if you end up leaving a clot inside and that clot is stationary, what do we call that?
Thrombus,
good. And if that clot breaks free and is now on the move?
Embolism,
right, good. And if you take a drug called an anticoagulant, what does it prevent from happening? Good. Prevent that clot from forming, right? So anticoagulants are actually, you know, called blood thinners, but there's a misnomer there. Blood thinning is something that we think of as making the blood less viscous. And that's not what the blood anticoagulants actually do. They just interfere with that coagulation process. We can take several different kinds of drugs here and look at those as being anticoagulants. They fight a particular different part of that coagulation mechanism. We actually make our own heparin, and we make our own very small amounts of anticoagulants by our white blood cells. But, you know, a lot of these drugs here can interfere with some part of that clotting process. Okay, so I just want to make sure we hit that term there at the very bottom of your page. Do y'all have questions on coagulation or fibrinolysis? Okay, our next topic to finish up this chapter is blood disorders, and they're going to be found over on page, 26. I'm going to start you off with red blood cell disorders first. There's two different types we're going to discuss, one called anemia and another called polycythemia. These types of blood cell disorders specifically affect our red blood cells. All right, so the first one here, anemia, is actually some inability to transport adequate levels of oxygen. So let's think of some things that could go wrong with our ability to transport oxygen. Well, we'll see we've got numbers of red blood cells. Those could be deficient. What specifically binds and transports oxygen?
Hemoglobin inside the red blood cells.
Good. So you could have hemoglobin issues, right? What specific part of the hemoglobin molecule binds those oxygens? The heme group and the iron molecules, so there could be another set of issues there. So we can look at issues everything from red blood cell count to hemoglobin to the amount of iron that we have able to transport those oxygen molecules. On the converse, we've got a disorder called polycythemia. This is an excess number of red blood cells. We'll come back and talk about that one in just a moment. Let's first focus, though, on anemia. This particular picture shows us iron deficiency anemia, and you'll notice that the red blood cells here kind of have a spiky appearance. It's hard to see, but some of these have, like this one here, a pretty spiked look to them, and that comes from having not enough iron in the bloodstream. You know, if you have a complete blood count done, a lot of times they'll come back with a lot of other information besides just how many red blood cells you're transporting. Sometimes that complete blood count will tell you what the width is for those red blood cells. It will tell you what the shape is, you know, things of that sort. So if you have smaller than normal red blood cells, that can be an indicator for iron deficiency anemia. So a lot of things there may be hidden on a blood report can point to this condition. Who do you think is more likely to have this problem, males or females?
Females.
Females. Why females? Yeah, every month females lose blood, right? Okay, so those females that are in their menstruating years, sometimes between teenage years and the 50s, that's a long time to be losing blood every month. So if you have heavy menstrual flows for several months, that can tip you over the edge here into iron deficiency anemia. Let's talk about sickle cell anemia. This particular disorder is well traced on the genes. We know exactly how to predict who's going to end up with this disorder.
They're constantly in the hospital.
What's that?
They're constantly in the hospital.
I'm sure they are, yeah. Do you have the ones that are carriers or the ones that are full-blown coming in the hospital?
I don't know which one it is, but...
I'm betting you probably have the full-blown, full-blown cases.
You mean opposed to, like, their parents or something?
Well, but
it's disease.
The disease or the trade, yeah. And you probably
as a carrier would have no problem with the disease with it. You know, they could just be the ones to carry the disease on to their children.
That's right. That's right. If you have no sickle cell at all, then you don't have the allele that codes for blood cells that look like these. Okay. If you have what's called the trait, that means that you have one normal allele, which codes for normal red blood cells, and you have one faulty allele that codes for the sickled red blood cells. If you carry the trait, we call you a carrier, or we say, like you say, you have a trait for it, but you don't have the full-blown sickle cell disease. You may have some symptoms, but not the full-blown set of symptoms that you might see with somebody who's inherited both faulty alleles. If you've got what's called the full-blown disease, like this one here, then you've actually inherited the trait from both parents. And so you have two faulty alleles that code for faulty red blood cells. So that means that you're making these sickled red blood cells as opposed to the normal disc-shaped red blood cells. What do you think the problems might be with having sickled red blood cells?
It's harder for them to get through the blood.
Good, you're both right, yeah. There's difficult times getting those through a capillary, through a vessel. There's difficulty transporting oxygen, okay? What do you think some of the signs or symptoms are for a patient with sickle cell anemia, the full-blown disease?
A lot of pain,
weakness, shortness of breath, tiredness. They may even include fever, inflammation, a lot of joint pain, because you can imagine these sickled red blood cells traveling through the joints, how that painful that must be, okay? And so you can have two people who may not know that they carry that trait. There's a 1 in 4 chance that they have a baby with the sickle cell anemia, the full-blown disease. There's a 50% chance that their child just carries the trait and can then still pass it along. And there's a 25% chance that they have a child with no disorder whatsoever. So, you know, you're rolling the dice there if you have two parents with the trait have a child. There is an interesting side effect of this. In certain regions of Africa where malaria is prevalent, the malaria plasmodium does not infect their sickled red blood cells. So there's actually a resilience to having, you know, infections with malaria if you carry a sickle cell trait or the full-blown disease. So imagine that having a disease like this might make you resistant to having some other disease like malaria. And they think that's actually why people with sickle cell have persisted, that there's an advantage to having it if you live in the malaria parts of the world. So kind of an interesting trade-off there. Another form of anemia is this one. It's called vitamin B12 deficiency. We know that B12 is necessary to make those red blood cells, and without it, you may have what's called pernicious anemia. And so you can see in these pictures here, it doesn't look like a whole lot of red blood cells. In fact, there's quite a few platelets and even some white blood cells that look like they're more numerous than those red blood cells here. So where do you get B12 from? Plant matter or animals? Animals, yep. So unfortunately, if you are a vegetarian or a vegan, you have to get this particular vitamin through an injection. It is poorly absorbed through the digestive tract, but nonetheless, you can take supplements, but the injection is going to be a better way to get your B12. Okay, so anemia is a catch-all term that means that there's some disability in transporting adequate oxygen. What we have to then do is ask the question of, why are you having difficulty transporting oxygen? What's the underlying cause? So it could be everything from a low red blood cell count, as with pernicious anemia, misshapen red blood cells, as with sickle cell anemia, or perhaps a lack of iron there in an iron deficiency anemia. All right, so let's talk about polycythemia. What's the issue here?
Too many red blood cells.
Good. And we look at typically two underlying issues. What's one issue that could cause this condition? Right, good. Bone marrow could be producing too many immature red blood cells, and so they're not yet capable of transporting adequate oxygen. And another issue that could cause this?
Higher altitudes.
Good. So life at a higher altitude will naturally produce more red blood cells for that oxygen. Do you see any issue with transporting lots of red blood cells all the time? That's right, they could clog up a vessel, too many trying to get through. Yep, so unfortunately this means that we've got, you know, a more viscous blood, and a more viscous blood is a thicker blood, and that can ultimately lead to things like stroke or heart attack. All right, so we've got a host of white blood cell disorders here. Let me run you through these. A lot of these white blood cell disorders have a prefix starting with leuko. What does that tell us?
White
blood cells, good. Couple of clues here. Pneumonia is a low level of white blood cells. Cytosis is a condition of too many white blood cells. So use those prefixes and suffixes where you can. I think they're going to be helpful for this list. Let me start you off with leukemia, the first one up there. Okay. This one is a set of immature white blood cells released into the bloodstream. And, of course, the bone marrow is the one to release those white blood cells. If you're putting immature white blood cells in the bloodstream, are they able to do their jobs?
No.
No. So what might happen to you?
They start attacking the body.
They can attack the body, or you might catch everything. Yeah, so everything that comes along, you catch it because you can't fight it off. Okay. I'll come back to this slide in just a moment. Let me show you what happens with leukemia. A lot of the symptoms here simply look like somebody's got the flu. So you look at stuff like fatigue and loss of appetite, swollen lymph nodes. This looks like the flu, fever and infection, muscular weakness, feeling pain or tenderness in your bones and joints. So quite likely this person with leukemia may have caught some disease, maybe the flu or a cold, but they can't fight it off. There's some other things here that point to leukemia, though. Easy bleeding and bruising, these purplish spots or patches. This easy bleeding and bruising comes from the fact that we're producing not just immature white blood cells, but also immature red blood cells and immature platelets. So you've got just all sorts of immature cells being forced out into circulation. What immature cells lead to easy bruising?
Platelets.
Platelets, yeah. So you may have platelets that are unable to do their job. So we see things like these other telltale signs pop up with leukemia. All right, so one of the things that they may end up doing for this patient with leukemia is saying, you know, hey, bone marrow transplant is the way to go here. And hopefully with a bone marrow transplant, they can get cells that are then producing mature cells that are pushed into circulation, not these immature cells. Let's see, this condition here is called leukopenia, and this condition comes from having an inadequate number of white blood cells in circulation. And you'll notice that one of the things that can cause leukopenia is corticosteroids. So corticosteroids and glucocorticoids are essentially the same thing. What was the example of a glucocorticoid we discussed? Cortisol, good, good. So cortisol is the example we discussed for glucocorticoids. Do you remember what effect cortisol has on your immune system?
It suppresses
it. That's right, it suppresses it, good. So if you take corticosteroids, like cortisol, for a long time,
it's going to weaken your immune system.
Bingo, weaken your immune system so you catch everything that comes along. Unfortunately, that is a side effect for staying on corticosteroids for a long-term period. You are more susceptible to whatever comes your way. But the reason it's given is to suppress immune response in the case of an organ transplant. So people who have experienced an organ transplant may take cortisol or cortisone or some similar suppressant drug to keep their bodies from rejecting that organ. And in that case, we may see leukopenia, meaning what? Yeah, lower white blood cell count, right. This one here is called mono. It's infectious mononucleosis caused by a virus known as the Epstein-Barr virus. Ever heard of this one?
Mono.
Mono, right. You may have heard it called the kissing disease. Okay, so it is often, it's a very contagious disease. You can catch it from living in close quarters with somebody. You know, somebody sneezes and you're living in a small environment, then of course you can get it that way. If you're looking at, oh goodness, using same silverware, same glassware, those kinds of things, that can also be a good way to transmit this disorder. The problem with this disorder is the virus that gets into your bloodstream infects your monocytes. Thinking back, what do monocytes do to help us?
They eat.
Yeah, they eat. So if they're going to be eating for us, unfortunately, they may eat this virus, and then they themselves become contaminated with the virus. It may take months to heal your body if you have infectious mononucleosis and to form antibodies against this virus. Once you catch any virus, it is yours to keep forever. It hides, they typically hide somewhere in your body and they're suppressed by your immune system and your antibodies. And in the case here, the effects may linger in the form of chronic fatigue syndrome. So a person may experience tiredness and exhaustion for years after having had this particular virus.
Doesn't Epstein-Barr, if you have Epstein-Barr virus, you have it forever.
You have it forever, yeah.
Well,
Like any virus, yeah.
So any virus, no, you can't ever truly get rid of
it? That's right. You can never get rid of it. So if you have, like, the chicken pox, or, you know, nowadays we have the chicken pox vaccine. Let's say that you had the chicken pox.
Oh, that's true.
It hangs out, it hides. 20, 50 years later, you can have the shingles, which is the same virus. Yeah. People have herpes virus. It pops up. It rears its ugly head. It may go dormant, and then it can be excited to come back out again. Right, right, because you'll eventually keep mounting antibody response, and then it'll be faster response to it, but nonetheless, you still may have to fight that virus again. Last one here is called leukocytosis, and this is kind of an excess situation of too many white blood cells. What may cause you to have leukocytosis?
If you got an infection.
Got an infection, good. Do you remember which specific type of white blood cell eats bacteria? Neutrophils. Yeah, neutrophils do good. Okay, so in this picture, all these purple nuclei here represent many, many neutrophils. And if you are, say, sick, you go and get antibiotics. If they don't work, they may do a complete blood count and see which specific type of white blood cell is elevated. So that may simply indicate some type of infection. All right, let me go back to the screen, let you guys copy if you need anything here. I'll start my cough drop regime here for the day. I feel the tickle coming. Eventually this will stop.
That's the worst ever, that tickle in your throat.
And you know that you're gonna end up having a coughing fit, yeah. This has been going on for a month, I'm tired of it.
That's what everyone says, that it drags out and that cough. Feel better with that part.
That part, yeah. I've had this for almost 4 weeks, so it's like time to go.
So what you do, those got a bag from?
You had a flu or?
I think I had the flu, yeah. That first week of class, yeah.
You think?
A bank. Nothing else would dribble on this long, would it?
Bad thing is, but what you just said and all, you never truly get rid of it.
That's true. It's always your virus to keep, so that's kind of a scary thought. I'm just checking to see if anybody needs the screen. Okay. Just to make sure we're staying on pace with our content, I want to do like one page of heart anatomy for you. And then we'll just break free and do open review period. So I'm going to get you over to chapter 17, that's page 35. This chapter 17, 18, and 20 will be on test number 2, and I think these three chapters go really well together, unlike chapter 16 and 19, which have nothing to do with each other. So the next set of tests will be on cardiovascular system, and so chapter 18 is on the heart and 19 is on the blood vessels. Of course, the heart's function is to pump blood, and the blood vessels' function is to transport those that blood to the body. So let's talk about the location of the heart. The heart is a fist-sized organ. It is situated in the middle of your thoracic cavity. In fact, it has its own little snug compartment in between your two lungs, and that snug compartment is called what? Mediastinum, good. So right in between here, this is our mediastinum, where the heart is located. Most of us feel our heartbeat on the left side of our chest cavity, but in reality, your heart sits more or less dead center in the middle of your chest cavity. It's about a half of an inch skewed toward the left side, but there is a reason that we feel the heartbeat on the left side. What pumping chambers are skewed toward the left? But what chambers down here pump? Those ventricles. Yes, sir. Because of their pumping activity, that's why we tend to feel the heart more on the left side of the chest. than we do anywhere else. Okay, and here's just another view of how the heart is situated. This is a cross-section through the thoracic cavity. You'll notice back here is the vertebrae. And then we've got these two bronchial tubes. And then come up this way, the heart is actually sitting right up underneath the sternum, which is easy to remember if you think about the word mediastinum and sternum are kind of in the same neighborhood in terms of their pronunciation. So the heart has a set of layers going around it from the outside. I'd like to talk to you about these layers. First of all, let me take it back to Bio-210. You may have talked in Bio-210 about a set of serous membranes. Can you tell me how they were constructed? That is innermost. Good. Okay, so in terms of serous membranes on the outside, there are two layers there. There is a parietal serous membrane, and then there is a visceral serous membrane. So when we look at this busy picture, the visceral membrane is actually the innermost of the two. I'll come back and look at that one in just a minute. So imagine that your heart was sitting inside where this visceral membrane is located. The visceral membrane is the one that directly adheres to or attaches to the heart muscle itself. There is an alternate name for the visceral pericardium. Do you know the name?
Epicardium.
Good. Okay. So there's an alternate name for the visceral pericardium. It's alternately called epicardium. Like all serous membranes, there are two layers. In between those two layers, there is a fluid called serous fluid. Okay, so in this picture between numbers 1 and 2, this space here, that's the housing for our serous fluid. And what is the function of serous fluid?
Lubricates,
reduces friction around that organ. Good. The outermost of the two layers is this one here, number 2 in this picture. And this number 2 represents our parietal pericardium. So it is an outermost, more loose sac, you might say, around the heart. Okay, so just to review, we've got two layers for the serous membrane. We have an innermost layer called what? Visceral, good. Visceral pericardium and epicardium are the same thing. The outermost of the two serous membranes is this one here, number 2. It's called what?
Parietal.
Parietal. Good, that's it. And between those two layers is a fluid called?
Serous fluid.
Good. Now, if I were to add another layer here, I would have to come out and draw it out here as number 3. And in fact, there is a third layer around the heart. It is called the fibrous pericardium. So if I were to continue adding layers, I would put one out here. I would glue it to number 2, and I would call it my fibrous pericardium. So let me work this another way. Let me work this from superficial to deep. We're just going to reverse our order now and go back toward the heart. If our fibrous pericardium is our outermost layer, it is directly anchored to your number 2 here, which is your parietal pericardium. Your parietal pericardium is a serous membrane. And between parietal and visceral is a little serous fluid, good. Come in one more layer. That number 1 is our visceral pericardium, otherwise called epicardium, good. So we were going from deep to superficial, and now we've just reversed it, and we've come from superficial to deep. So fibrous, parietal, and then, of course, visceral. This is a busy picture. Let's do it from the superficial to the deep once again. This is our fibrous pericardium. It is our outermost covering around the heart. It is glued to or attached to our parietal layer of the serous membrane. Okay, so they're stuck together. There's a space right here. They call it the pericardial space. That is space for our serous fluid. come in one more. That is our visceral layer. That visceral layer is anchored to the heart muscle itself. Notice the visceral layer and epicardium are the same layer, just two names for the same thing. So to just repeat this, if you've ever bought double-sided gift wrap, okay, double-sided gift wrap has a print on one side, peel it back, there's a print on the other side, right? Okay, you can't really separate the two layers. It's just print on each side of your gift wrap. That's how this fibrous layer and the parietal layer are. One side is fibrous, turn it back, the other side is parietal, okay? So you really can't take those two parts away from each other. You know, as you continue coming in, the epicardium or visceral pericardium is anchored to myocardium. What is myocardium?
Heart muscle.
Heart muscle. Okay, and one more layer in, the innermost layer of the heart wall is?
Endocardium.
Yeah, endocardium, good. Okay, so here's a real picture of a heart. You'll notice letter B is the membrane that directly anchors to the myocardium. What must that be? Okay, it's the same thing that anchors directly to the heart muscle. So this letter B must be epicardium or visceral. Good. So you can call it two things, visceral pericardium or epicardium. Okay. Notice they've peeled back letter A. Because you're looking at the side that's been peeled back, what is A? Parietal pericardium. And if you were to fold that back down over the heart, the outside would be?
Fibrous.
Good, good. And I like this picture because you can at least see there is a space between this visceral pericardium and the outermost layer. What would be found in that space? Serous fluid, good, good. All right, any questions so far about fibrous, parietal, and visceral layers? So if you happen to have excess fluid accumulate between the visceral and parietal pericardia, then you may have a condition called cardiac tamponade, heart plug, or pericardial effusion. You're gonna find in this chapter they have 2 to 3 to even 4 names for the same topic. And so if you're working in the hospital and somebody's talking about a patient with heart plug, you're thinking, well, I'll learn that it's cardiac tamponade, same thing, right? All on the same page. The issue here is somebody can have a heart attack. If the heart attack ruptures the heart muscle, the person can bleed into that space between the pericardial layers. So it may be blood coagulated between the layers. You may also have pus that can accumulate there from an infection. We may also see excess serous fluid leak into that pericardial space. Anything in that pericardial space is going to put pressure back in on the heart itself. What do you think a person's going to feel like if something's squeezing on their heart? Not going to be pleasant. Heaviness in the chest.
Chest pains. Hard time getting a breath.
Yep. So yeah, you've got some of these here. Problems breathing, difficulty breathing, may not feel completely like blood's getting to their head, so you know, faintness and lightheadedness. They may in fact have chest pain, so a lot of this sounds like heart attack, doesn't it? You may notice in this previous picture, there is a syringe pictured here. That is one way to relieve the pressure around the heart, is to insert a syringe into the layers and then suction out whatever's in there. So if you were doing this, let's go back to our previous picture, this one here. What layers would you penetrate to pull fluid from that pericardial sac space? Yeah, hip fibers first, and then which next? Yeah, the serous pericardium, that parietal layer. And if you're trying to pull excess fluid from this pericardial space, that's as far as you would have to go, right? So I'll tell you an easy way to remember this. If you know what tampons do, tampons are plugs, right? And their job is to soak up fluid. That's what you want to have happen if you have cardiac tamponade. You want something to soak up and remove that excess fluid around the heart. So So hopefully that'll help you keep those terms straight. All right, so we've talked about myocardium and endocardium. Let's take a look at myocardium for just a moment. In these pictures of real hearts, it is the thickest portion of the ventricles. And just taking a trip back to Bio210, I know you guys have talked about cardiac muscle tissue structure. What are some of the things that make cardiac muscle tissue different?
The intercalated discs.
Good. Intercalated discs. There's one right there that actually allows for ions and electrolytes to travel from one cell to the next. What else makes this one different?
It looks like powerful top lines of each of the tissue.
Okay, so kind of separate cells, you might say. Okay. So you'll notice these cells don't actually touch. There's a white space in between them, and that's so that we don't have nerve impulses traveling just haywire wherever. We want nerve impulses to travel in one direction only, and that is the length of the cell. Something else about heart muscle tissue, you probably have never heard anybody with heart cancer, right? Okay? That's because heart muscle tissue is amitotic, meaning that it does not do what? If it's amitotic, it cannot?
Replicate.
Cannot replicate, that's right. Actually, there is a nucleus there. It's just that we can't have these cells divide. They're mature and then they don't undergo cell division.
They can't keep multiplying.
So the good news is, you know, heart cancer is off the list of things to worry about, right? Okay. But the bad news is, if you have heart muscle tissue damage, the only thing we can repair with is collagen fibers, which is scar tissue. And if you remember collagen fibers, do they have the stretchiness of muscle tissue? They do not. And so if your heart muscle needs to stretch in order to recoil and contract, scar muscle or scar tissue is not like muscle tissue in that aspect. So there is some research going on where they're inserting satellite cells into heart muscle tissue, hopefully allowing the damaged muscle tissue to regenerate new cells. So that may be some hope on the horizon for people who've had, say, multiple heart attacks and heart muscle tissue damage. All right, bottom of your page there, the pericardium may also experience pericarditis. That's inflammation of what? Pericardium. And this is different from cardiac tamponade. This may be less serous fluid than normal. And what do you think those serous membranes do when there's less fluid?
They go brush up against another wall, there's friction.
Good, yeah, they friction, they rub. So that could be very painful. And if you've got pericarditis, we look at the root cause. It may, in fact, be something like pneumonia. And I know you say, well, wait a minute, pneumonia affects the lungs, right? Well, that can also travel over and irritate the outside lining of the heart. So if you treat the root problem, you can then treat and get rid of this. Endocarditis is another issue. What specifically is inflamed here?
Endocardium,
good. And you'll notice what looks to be pus that is accumulated on these heart valves. That's a bad thing because those heart valves are meant to prevent backflow of blood. There are certain types of fever, like fever that comes from scarlet fever or strep throat, that can cause inflammation of these heart valves. So, you know, a lot of times people say, you know, I don't have insurance. I'm just going to ride this out. I think I can get through this. And if it's something like strep throat, it can cause kidney damage. And it can also cause heart damage because of the way that bacteria infiltrates your body.
So
strep
throat
can cause problems with your heart, can cause problems with your kidneys. Yeah. So, you know, if it's the world's worst sore throat ever, that's the time to get it checked. All right, so I'd like to leave you some time for Q&A. I will leave off here to page 35 at the bottom, and then, you know, when we start class again next Wednesday, we'll pick up with 36. I'm done with material and ready for your questions.
As far as disorders go, not blood disorders, disorders, like endocrine, endocrine system disorders like hypothyroidism, all of those things, diabetes. How in depth should we be studying symptoms? Are you typically putting lots of questions on there saying these are the symptoms, what would this disorder be or no?
I would guarantee if there are questions that say, is it hypo or hypersecretion, and is it a what hormone?
Okay.
In terms of symptoms, I try not to pick just one. If there's multiple, I'll try to give you several.
Okay.
The only time I might give you one is when there's only like one issue, like blood sugar issues for, say, diabetes mellitus.
Okay.
So if you're looking at Graves' disease or Addison's that have like 15,
yes.
Gosh, no. Just get a feel for what might be the overall issue, like weight loss versus weight gain. Is there blood sugar problems? But don't memorize the list.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. Okay, the question was to look at direct gene activation and secondary messenger system. And just to kind of set the stage for this, we just want to appreciate that not all hormones can make their way across the plasma membrane. Some of them can if they're steroid-based. If they're not, if they're protein-based, then they're too big typically to pass into the cell. So what that means is we've got to have two mechanisms for these hormones to communicate with their target cells. So the type that proteins use, since they cannot travel into your cell, is called the secondary messenger system. And the type that is used by steroid hormones, which are lipid-based, they can enter the cell because they can agree with those phospholipid bilayers. That mechanism is called direct gene activation. Okay, so let's talk through these two first. So if you have a protein-based hormone, protein hormones are too large to pass through the phospholipid bilayer, and they come in contact with the cell by way of its plasma membrane. That's as far as they can go. So the receptor for the protein-based hormone must be
outside.
Good. That hormone plays the role as your first messenger. When it docks with your receptor on the plasma membrane, that turns on a series of events inside the cell. Now, the one particular event that we really focused on was called CAMP. Cyclic AMP, or CAMP for short, and what role does it play? Second. Yeah. It's your second messenger, right? So if you can't carry the message inside yourself, the next best thing is to get your messenger to do it for you. And so the second messenger here, CAMP, carries or relays the message from the hormone into the cell. And so that turns on protein kinases, that turns on maybe mitosis occurring more quickly or ramps up metabolism speeds. Whatever the case is, we're going to change the activity of this cell.
So because the protein can't enter into the cell, it makes CAMP be able to take the message inside the cell because it can't enter.
That's correct, yeah. Since the protein-based hormone can't enter, it taps CAMP, it turns on CAMP, and CAMP does the work. Most of our hormones in the body are protein-based. That means most of them operate by this mechanism. There are a handful that operate by this direct gene activation system. The steroid hormones that come from your adrenal glands fall into this category. And then there's always an exception to the rule.
That's the thyroid hormone.
Thyroid hormone, right. Thyroxine plays by this game here. So a steroid hormone can travel directly across your phospholipid bilayer. And since it can, we don't have to put the receptor outside. We can put the receptor on the inside. So when the hormone binds the receptor, we now activate a process known as what?
Transcription
and translation. Good. What are we making? New proteins. Yes, so transcription and translation means we're making new proteins. And I think that this is probably not in news to anybody, but testosterone is a steroid. It makes you grow muscle and hair, right? OK. Okay, so this is certainly nothing new in relating that protein synthesis is activated by a steroid-based hormone. So this is not really our goal to speed up anything necessarily, but rather to activate protein synthesis thanks to those steroids. Anything here I can go back over for you?
Will there be any labeling on the exam?
Any pictures will be multiple choice, and I'm thinking I don't have any pictures this time. How about anything else on that early part of the endocrine system?
Can you go over like what you said would be good topics for your discussion?
Use old tests. They give you good samples of how things are worded. But common things that I tend to hit over and over are blood pressure. You know, when I say blood pressure, that opens up a can of worms, right?
Yeah, yeah.
then you've got ADH, you've got aldosterone. There's too many, yes. It's a big can of worms. And then, okay, then I think now about problems like diabetes insipidus, because that's related to ADH. If you've got excess cortisol, let's say you're taking steroids, and you're taking something that increases your blood sugar level, and then on top of that you already have diabetes mellitus, that's going to cause, the diabetes by itself can mean that you've got high blood sugar. Now you're just doubling that with the excess cortisol.
Okay.
So you're just making your problem worse. That's all you have to talk about. Yeah. Yeah, so look at blood pressure issues. Look at that particular question, that, you know, the cortisol-diabetes relationship. That's a good one to look at. I always have a question on there about looking at blood types, what's compatible, what's not compatible. Things to also look at are agglutination versus coagulation. We've talked about that a few times. That's it. Get the fiber mesh network. Coagulation versus agglutination, could you explain how those are totally different? But I don't think you'll go wrong if you spend some time on aldosterone, ADH, insulin, cortisol. Those are some good ones that'll carry you far on this test. So things like aldosterone, ADH, insulin, cortisol, those are good ones to make sure you fully understand. I would also go back and make sure I understood antagonists, you know, which hormones could you classify as antagonists, which ones could you classify as synergists. Yeah, A and P is the antagonist to aldosterone. That's right, to aldosterone. Juanita?
What is the problem
for essay questions? That's what we're doing. It's blood pressure, blood glucose regulation. Those are always good ones to look at. Look at whether or not blood types are compatible. You know, could you explain why it's okay to give O to A and not the other way around? You know, things like that are really good to look at. Yeah, be able to explain agglutination is different from a coagulation and why they're different. How about other topics I can go back and review for them? Are you feeling at this point it's a matter of just going and getting it to stick? Okay. If you guys run into anything that you're stuck on, let me know. I'll be happy to help you tomorrow, even Wednesday morning. Any blood topics you can think of that I can help you with? One of those hormones that tells another gland to do something, put what its target is on there. So where it's made, its action, and if it's involved in any kind of further communication with another gland. The chart on page 17 is one that might work well to just take them row by row and put them in a flashcard. And I think if you make that in flashcards, you'll have done your studying. How about your next topic? Anything else I can help you with? I didn't pass the sign-in sheet today, so just wanted you to know that. All right, I'll see y'all on Wednesday.